This is Orson Welles speaking. You know, if television ever shoves plain radio out of business, I don't know what'll happen to us commentators. You may be willing to let one man talk at you for 15 minutes, but you won't be able to stand looking at him for the same length of time. So I guess broadcasts like these will be illustrated. Your screen will be treated to a series of news photos, maps, charts, explanatory animation, and so forth. Well, if the forward march of technological progress had turned your obedient servant into a landslide lecture as early as this week, my visual text for this little Sabbath talk would be a certain news photo. I saw it a few days ago in a weekly magazine. It's a snapshot of the remnants of a Japanese city called Hiroshima. As photography, the picture's none too good. As commentary, the picture's more eloquently meaningful than any words, explanatory or editorial, I'll manage to put together about it this morning. As a news photo, it's especially weak because it needs a second glance. A fast first look tells you that here's another panorama of the sterile garbage of the bomb. The same blank rubble and wreckage, the familiar tableau of ashes. You read the title, School at Hiroshima. You settle your eyes again on the picture above, and there it is, sure enough, out of the broken bones of a city, blossoming through its very ribs, is a tiny congregation of tiny children. A round-faced, round dozen of Japanese citizens-to-be, or citizens that might be. There they sit at their little desks, straight-backed, solemn, attending whatever it is their teacher, a young man in a farmer-style straw hat, a stooped and sorry-looking pedagogue may be finding appropriate to say to them. What can he be saying to them? What in the world, what in that world anyway, what wisdom cherished in that bleak and baking chaos can the schoolmaster in the straw hat be teaching the 12 little scholars of Hiroshima? The 3 R's, Japan's 3 R's, were reach, rule, and ruin. But even a schoolteacher could not sermonize there, not there, in the trash heap. Even that creature called Allied Spokesman would find it an uneasy task to stand before the 12 little scholars, the scholars of Hiroshima, and tell them they brought it on themselves. 2 and 2 make 4, oh yes, and energy is equal to MC squared, Einstein's equation for the conversion of mass into energy. Energy is equal to mass M multiplied by the velocity of light C squared. As always, the alphabet, of course, A is for atom, B is for bomb, the equivalent ideographs. Whatever the lesson, the scholars seem to be accepting it with at least a formal attentiveness, and one of them has his hand up. He seems to think he knows the answer. It's conceivable that he does. Or there's the likelihood that he's merely making the classic request. If he's asking, teacher, please, can he leave the room? The tragic joke of it is that there isn't any room to leave. This study hall is a hasty patch earnestly cleared out of the wilderness, the man-made wasteland. The little scholars of Hiroshima look to be about my daughter's age, so the class convening in the classroom would be Hiroshima's approximation of Santa Monica's third grade. This, then, is an introductionary course, a preparation for the studies commenced at Thebes, continued in the libraries of Alexandria and Rome, perhaps concluded in the laboratories at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Between the forging of metal and the splitting of the atom, between the wheel and the bomb is a treasury of thinking and discovery. Live and read 1,000 years without recess. The little scholars will never learn it all. But they know as well as any graybeard, better than most, the ultimate idiocy achieved by that experiment which began in the chill of the cave where the first fire was tamed. They have seen the fire tame the fire makers. Having been shown in a moment of time the end of time, the little scholars of Hiroshima bring to their studies certain apprehensions of the apocalypse. A thunderbolt dreadfully announced to those little ears the news that the search for truth may end in the ionosphere, higher than man will ever fly, deeper than ever plummet sounds, the plummet itself radar-controlled and sounding, if you forgive the pun, the very crack of doom. The little scholars, who are as young as my oldest daughter, confront their primary education with a queer and particular sophistication. They know how the mystery ends. They've read the last chapter. By lightning 10 times brighter than the day, they have been shown the blackness of the period which marks the end of the last paragraph, the full stop, which is endless night. It's a hope for the world to hang on to that seated at their dozen desks, with nothing between their young heads and the dangerous sky, the little scholars will arrive at certain conclusions useful to the problem presently confronting all of us on all the blackboards of the earth. Children may solve that problem, for the problem may be simple. It certainly can be stated very simply. X equals survival. What is X? Once man made an X of wood. Some fearful priests, nameless in history and a servant of empire and a Pisa named Pilate, nailed a teacher to that wooden X, resolving the equation with the corpse of the Son of Man. For those calling themselves Christians, this forever solved the problem. X plus the martyred teacher was Christ on the cross. X equals salvation. I do not know whether the little scholars studying in a classroom founded on the scar of a city will reach the answer in the words of a teacher who told men to turn the other cheek. Conceivably, the span of the longest prophecy is past, and the time is upon us for new prophets. Conceivably, the old visions no longer illuminate. There was a man who searched his soul under a banyan tree. There was a man who found the devil in the desert, who named the one god Ahura Mazda. There was a man who prayed in a garden at Gethsemane. There was a man who brought the law down out of Sinai, who died on another mountain, straining his old eyes toward the promised land. The promised land he might not enter, flowing with milk and honey. The resting place his people never really reached. Conceivably, these men, all of them, are out of date. Conceivably, the present race of man is out of date. There were teachers whose conversations, carefully pursued in the well-tempered groves of civilized antiquity, defined the nature of man himself, drew up plans which are still available for a whole architecture of human living. Today, the crude riddle of hunger confounds the children of Greece. Empires contend in the streets of Athens, joining new ruins with the old. We've listened without replying to the guns of civil war exclaiming among the crippled pillars of the Acropolis. In Rome were poets and lawmakers, were saints and numberless executives of the Roman Church. Here in the seat and seed place of empire, new and old empires today clash and scheme. Murder feeds the stones of Rome with fresh blood, spilt in causes which have lost all pattern or any purpose. A cardinal of the Roman Church, a priest whose people dwell on another tragic battleground of freedom's fight, is staring straight into the face of an authentic devil today. The devil is called Pogrom. He is blind, with ravening teeth. The devil Pogrom is torture and shame. The devil Pogrom should be as unfamiliar by name as Beelzebub, but you'll see that name copied on the front pages of tomorrow's newspapers. The cardinal in Poland could exorcise that demon or show his scarlet hat squarely in the ranks of those in Poland who are the fighting adversaries of race hate, but the cardinal disapproves of some of these and prefers not to be counted in their number. This week, Jews were clubbed and stoned, beaten, maimed, tortured. This little more than a year after Hitler's defeat. 41 Jews were murdered in Poland last week. And this the cardinal finds highly regrettable. But he says the Jews were not murdered because they were Jews. In a city called Kielce, there's a street called Planty. And here a little boy led a mob last week to a building where he claimed to have seen the bodies of 15 Gentile children, victims of the Jews. Blood sacrifices of a secret Jewish ritual. Men and women and children who made their homes in that building, Jews to the number of 27, were turned out of those homes by the lynch mob and tortured until they died. Now, the myth of murdered Christian babies is one of the oldest lies in the whole history of hate. The little boy who repeated it admitted later that he'd been coached, carefully coached, by certain grown-ups. That even in the mania of the moment, he didn't believe it himself. But the cardinal doesn't believe that the Jews were murdered because they were Jews. The cardinal says the Jews themselves were mostly to blame for being murdered. It seems the cardinal doesn't want to move over to the place where the fight is being fought against race baiting because some of the fighters are enemies of the church. The cardinal would have us think that the foe of a religion is worse than the foe of a race. That it is better to deny the brotherhood of man than to deny the motherhood of Rome. This is not a new heresy, but if any heresy ever uproots the church, it will be this heresy. If the grandeur and greatness, the good works, the accumulated wisdom of Rome are ever set at naught, it will be because ordained soldiers of the church militant have preferred preservation to peace. Because a sufficiency of priests, speaking under the banners of the Prince of Peace, place power before peace and put the politics of power before the all-absorbing business of goodwill toward men. There's another orthodoxy, a political orthodoxy, with missionaries and priests, with an immense flock of the faithful and its own kind of cardinals. Its Rome is in Moscow, its Mecca, its highest altar, a tomb in the Red Square. This is the political orthodoxy, centered in the Soviet Union and called communism. This orthodoxy, like all others, denies truth to every way but its own. Papal infallibility is no more inflexible than the bulls issued by the Politburo. There are heroes to substitute for saints, pamphlets to take the place of prayers. There are feast days and observances. There is everything but God. Those whose hope it is that Stalin's government in Russia will finally fail and fall believe that godlessness is the cue word for that destruction. For myself, I hold that if the triumphs of a terrible war and the peacetime victories of that government over ignorance and disease and savagery can ever be set at naught, it will be for the same mistakes, the only mistakes, which could ever destroy that other orthodoxy, the orthodoxy of religion. To put the machinations of power before the service of peace, this is the fatal disease which aggregations of great power are heir to. There was a scholar who studied in a public library in London, a German who found in England a formula and a vocabulary for the socialist ideal. In England now, there is a socialist government. But it's easy to guess what Karl Marx would have to say about the virulent aggressions in the near and far east of that capitalist empire, that socialist government, is vainly but with such ugly vehemence seeking to preserve. The partisans of England's socialist government will tell us there's no other cause of action possible. And the partisans and party members called communists will tell you that the ends justify the means. I wonder. In Paris, barricades are the symbol of the people's battle. There have been barricades in Paris, and there are no Frenchmen today too young to remember the last of them. But the pattern of a people's peace is still a crazy quilt, and high-hearted brothers in arms who knew where to go and where to fight the very day the Nazis thought they won have lost their way since the Nazis lost, and worse yet, they've lost the heart to find the way. To the rest of the Earth's inhabitants, we Americans, who for a time seemed the well-armed champions of a free world, look puffed with our own dollar greed and doomed to the confusions of raw empire. If this were television, I'd show you that picture again, the news photo of the classroom blossoming in the ruins. It's a tragic picture, you'll take my word for that, but you'd have to see it to see what I mean when I tell you that in some curious sense beyond the expression of words, it's a hopeful picture. It shows the stirring of life, exactly where life had no cause or call to stir again. It shows order when only anarchy could be expected to dwell. It shows children, and in this old world, this very old world, I don't know anything better to look at. The children are learning something. After the bomb, we might have thought there was nothing left to learn, or at least nothing worth learning. We might have thought there were no children with a heart to learn. We might have expected there'd be no children. But here they are in a news photo, straight and solemn behind their dozen tidy desks, alive and what's more, industriously preparing to grow up in Hiroshima, of all places. Of all places in this ugly, drunken world. Now, this broadcast was not intended as a tribute to Japanese childhood, but rather to the glorious mystery of renewal, the stubborn indestructibility of mankind. On the ticker tape in the newsroom this morning, I found no good omens. The word is bad amongst us and the sky black over our heads. There are no reasons in the headlines for anything but despair, but inside the newspaper are little signs and signals, little winks of encouragement. These are very slight, but so appears a beacon in a storm. If it's big enough to see, it's tremendous. Finally, I don't expect that our future is in the hands of the coming generation of Japanese. I offer no particular welcome to a messiah growing up in Hiroshima. He is hypothetical and worse, unlikely, but one of the 12 little scholars has his hand raised. And if he's got an answer, we can use one. Now it's time to say goodbye. Thank you very much for letting me come to call. This time, please let me join you next week, same time. Till then, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
We invite you to tune in again next week over most of these ABC stations for a commentary by Orson Welles. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.